Welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And my guest for this interview is Dr. Justin Marchegiani. I think I got that right.
Excellent.
I've just been practicing.
Good job, Alex.
Welcome, Justin.
And thank you.
Just to give a little bit of Justin's background before we get into it, Dr. Justin is a graduate of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst with a degree in kinesiology and pre-medical studies. Dr. Justin has completed his doctorate degree in chiropractic from Life West University and is a licensed doctor of chiropractic in the state of Texas. He has completed postgraduate study in the area of clinical nutrition, rehabilitative exercise, and functional medicine, so he can offer the most cutting-edge techniques to help address the patient's growing healthcare needs. Dr. Justin works with a wide variety of patients, all the way from athletes trying to increase performance and heal from injuries, to the everyday person with chronic health challenges. Using a holistic approach, Dr. Justin addresses core underlying barriers to health, which allow his patients to heal faster and feel better. Justin, great to have you here. Thank you so much for making the time.
Hey, Alex. Thanks so much for having me a part of the show. I'm really excited.
Awesome. So I always like to start a little bit of people's own personal stories, what's brought them into doing the work that they're doing. And I know that you had a little bit of your own experience around your digestive system affecting your thyroid. So maybe just touch on a little bit, what got you so interested in the thyroid and hormones and that part of functional medicine?
Well, before I even knew it, I actually had Hashimoto's, which is an underlying autoimmune condition where your immune system is attacking your thyroid. And your thyroid is really important because this summit's all on fatigue. And your thyroid controls kind of the metabolic baseline of your body, right? In your conventional biochemistry textbook, right? Metabolism is like the sum of all chemical reactions in your body. But what that really equals is temperature and energy. And then, of course, from there, you can spiral off and have hair issues and mood issues, anxiety, depression. You can even have slow motility or bacterial overgrowth. So, of course, a thyroid issue, autoimmune can spin off into many, many symptoms and many, many issues. So I had an underlying thyroid issue, but before that, kind of backing off a few years even before that, I worked in the surgical field and I would was a kind of a surgical assistant. I would help kind of hold the patient position, then help the surgeon during surgery if they needed, like for instance, holding the diabetic limb of a patient that was getting amputated. So I had many experiences of all these limbs passing through my possession. And there really wasn't a lot of curiosity on the surgeon to get in front of this and to fix this. They really were missing a lot of tools in their tool belt to assess it. I mean, imagine a contractor working on your house and they don't have a hammer or let's just say a screwdriver. Well, it's like there's a lot of things they're probably going to see and they're just going to overlook it because those important tools are missing. And, you know, I look at it from a surgeon's perspective. They have two major tools. They have surgery and drugs, and they're missing key ones such as diet and lifestyle and supplementation. So I really wanted to get ahead of that and kind of put more tools in my toolbox. So when I looked at patients, I could really evaluate them 360 and really work on getting to the root cause and getting upstream versus being downstream.
Very cool. Very cool. And you touched on kind of the broad reaching impact of the thyroid, but for people which maybe are not so aware of what the thyroid does and why it's important, maybe say a bit about why the thyroid is such a key piece of the jigsaw in understanding fatigue and driving fatigue-related symptoms.
It's a great question. So your thyroid gland is going to be right here in your throat. So if you feel your Adam's apple, that little bump, right, more prominent if you're a guy, and if you come down maybe a centimeter and out a centimeter, this area is going to be your thyroid gland. And that area can get, it's very common to have autoimmune attack there. It just tends to be a very sensitive tissue for a lot of different reasons. The surface proteins on gluten tend to be a big connecting factor with that as well. And it's one of the most common thyroid issues. Organochlorines and various pesticides also can attack that area, or let's just say can stress that area out and stress out your immune system, create more gut permeability, which exacerbates that immune response. So in regards to thyroid, think of like your thyroid is like kind of you're in your car, right? You turn on the car, your resting RPM rate, that's like your thyroid, okay? So we know like in the wintertime when the engine's cold, right, that RPM is really, really like running high to overcompensate versus when it's hotter, right? And maybe it may run lower and be easier to redline, so to speak. And we know if your engine goes too low on the resting RPMs, especially if you have experience driving a standard, you stall out, right? So think of that resting engine kind of tone or RPM rate, that's your thyroid. Your ability to shift gears, from first gear to second gear, which is analogous to dealing with more stress. That's like your adrenal glands. First to second, okay, now you're in fifth gear, lots of stress. Now you're coming home, you're winding down. That now you're downshifting, right? You're downshifting to help recover from stress. And think of all the, let's just say the fuel in the engine is like the mitochondria. That's like the B vitamins and the CoQ10 and all these nutrients to help run our ATP pathways to generate energy. So kind of the triangle I like to kind of put people kind of wrap their heads around is resting engine tones, our thyroid, and the shifting gears going up and going down, ramping up from stress and coming back down from stress is your adrenals. And then the nutrients that kind of help run that mitochondria, that energy center in the cell, that powerhouse is going to be the mitochondria. So that's kind of the triad there. Does that help?
That's a really helpful way of looking at it. And actually, in a little bit, it would be great to talk a bit more about how those pieces interrelate. So if you're deficient in one area, how it's likely to impact the other areas. But maybe before we do that, just say a little bit about if someone's thyroid is not functioning as it should, what are some of the symptoms that somebody would notice?
Great question. So I like to draw a line here because we have our typical symptoms and then we have our atypical symptoms. So our typical are going to be like cold hands and feet, right? Hair loss, outer third of the eyebrow thinning. Those are like our typical low thyroid symptoms, right? And then on the other side of the fence, we may have anxiety and depression. Okay. They've done studies. You know, they compare lithium and T3 hormones for patients that have depression, and T3 actually did better than lithium, the actual medication. Right? Wow,
that's interesting. Yeah.
Or a typically used for bipolar, but in general, it did better. So it you can see mood-related issues. Of course, fatigue, which is kind of typical, but then you can see anxiety, depression. You can see constipation or low bowel motility, right? You could see brain fog, cognitive issues. You may even see fingernail issues, like vertical ridging in the nails, etc. So these are all real powerful examples of what that could look like.
That's super interesting. And I think one of the things that can be challenging is when someone's trying to get clarity around what may be causing symptoms they've got. As you mentioned, there are some specific symptoms to thyroid issues, which are kind of red flags beyond your traditional kind of fatigue symptoms, let's say. So you mentioned, for example, cold hands and feet. You mentioned the kind of resting level of kind of capacity of the body. So they would be good clues if they are prominent symptoms of somebody that the thyroid would be a key place to go and get more clarity and to go and look.
Correct. And then I find patients that have fatigue issues, they have, you know, everyone has the right to have more than one issue going on at once. But when I see my patients that, you know, okay, this is female, right? Maybe there's fatigue. We run some history. There's some autoimmunity in the family. Maybe there's already another diagnosed autoimmune issue. So, okay, we're going to look at and we're going to run a full thyroid panel. We're already thinking that. But some people, you come into contact and you think, oh, it's definitely their thyroid, but then their adrenals are in their tank. Their cortisol is so low. And sometimes the cortisol, which is made by your adrenals, sometimes it's the adrenal cortisol issue that's causing the thyroid to be low because we need adequate level of cortisol to activate our thyroid hormone. So we have our TSH, which is the primary hormone that we're measuring to assess thyroid function. Guess what? Not a thyroid hormone. It's a brain hormone. So TSH is here. Then we have T4, right? Because TSH, then it's the volume that talks to the thyroid. And then the thyroid makes T4, all right, which is relatively inactive, right? And then it gets converted throughout the body peripherally, but also throughout the body, liver, gut, metabolically throughout the body. And we need various nutrients to make this conversion, selenium, zinc, magnesium, CoQ10, vitamin A. But if we have imbalances in cortisol, very low or very high levels of cortisol, that could alter our ability to activate and make conversion. It also can affect the volume coming from the brain. People that have very high amounts of stress, high cortisol, it could actually lower your TSH, which is that brain hormone. So you can see how the adrenals can easily interplay either with conversion downstream with T4 to T3 or upstream by altering the volume and how the pituitary and the hypothalamus right up in here talk to that thyroid downstream.
Yes. And as you've got deficiency in one area, of course, the body then tries to compensate to find a way to balance with other areas, right? So if someone, for example, has got blockages in mitochondrial function, or they've just completely burnt out their system and they're kind of in a crash, then they're going to start to pull on their adrenals and their thyroid to try and find whatever way the body can to kind of get energy and get things moving. So you tend to have a ripple impact from one being impacted to the others.
100%. So we want to have a couple of ways that we look at and assess things. So we look at things subjectively. Hey, let's line up all your symptoms. And then when I hear a symptom, most people on the conventional side, they're like, what drug can I prescribe? Or, hey, what symptoms, what category of symptoms does that fit into where I can label it a disease and then prescribe you a drug, right? Or you may have like people on the natural side that may say, hey, what nutrient can I give to control the symptom? They're still giving nutrients to control symptoms. I'm thinking about it, hey, how can we go upstream? And what symptoms would that lead us to think is an upstream issue? So if I see fatigue downstream, I may look at the thyroid and adrenals upstream. So I look at the clues with the symptoms down below and I go up to the systems above, and that gives me clues on what systems could be at play. But then we'll also run lab tests to figure out the function of those systems. So if we see these systems aren't functioning well, hormone, gut, detoxification, digestion, infections, if we see there is issues in any of those systems, then that gives us the ability to then work on the systems and not necessarily worry about the symptoms, because if the systems are addressed, everything trickles downstream. And then of course the next step is looking at the underlying stressors that could cause the system issues. Physical, chemical, emotional stress, whether it's too much exercise, too little. It could be food issues on the chemical side like gluten or inflammatory foods, junky fats, too much sugar, too much carbohydrate. It could be nutrient deficiencies. It could be infections, right? It could be emotional stress, poor sleep, relationship stress, financial stress. So kind of the model in which I've created, which that helps me kind of educate my patients, because I see patients from all over the world, is to the SSS approach. We have the stressors over here that then mount up, and we have our stress reserves. Once over capacity, we have our systems start to break down, hormone, gut infections, detox, nutrients. And then when these systems break down, then we have the symptoms down here. Most people are just myopically here. We want to go upstream to the systems and then also upstream to the underlying stressors that predisposed everything. Does that make sense?
That's a really neat model. And I want to come back to that a bit more in a little bit. Before we do that though, you mentioned that you run various lab tests and also you're looking at the kind of the picture of symptoms. I think one of the things that often confuses patients is that they might read something online about thyroid. They will go and see their general practitioner. They'll get a standard set of blood tests. And maybe they'll test T4 and TSH and they'll say, yeah, that's fine. It's within the reference range.
Yes.
And maybe say a little bit about kind of functional reference ranges versus standard reference ranges, and also why just looking at kind of that fairly narrow picture can be limiting. Because there may well be people that are watching or listening to this that believe they have thyroid issues, have thyroid issues, but have been told that they haven't because they perhaps have done that fairly basic level testing.
Yeah, those are some very insightful questions. So there's two major issues, right? The first one is what tests are being run? Because a lot of times the adequate tests aren't even being looked at to even assess the whole picture. And then the second issue is, all right, what ranges? Okay, let's say you run these markers. Now, what's the acceptable ranges? So there's two kind of issues. So let me deal with the actual marker issue first. So your conventional MD or even your endocrinologist may run TSH, maybe a T4 total or T3 free. That's it. You're going to get typically two markers, maybe one. That's it. But you can see it doesn't give you the whole spectrum downstream, because number one, TSH is important, right? TSH makes stimulates the thyroid to make T4. We have our total and our free fraction of the hormone. So total is everything. It's the whole thing the gland's making. But then the free represents the bioavailable hormone that's not bound to a protein. This is the protein that binds to a receptor site. So think of a hormone as like a key. Think of the receptor site as the lock, right? So imagine you got 100 keys in someone's purse. That's the total fraction of the hormone. Think of the two keys that are actually in the person's hand, the 98 in the purse. That's like the free hormone. It can actually work and bind to the receptor site. So we have T4. Total and free. The same thing exists with T3, meaning we have the total fraction as well as the free. Think of the two keys in the person's hand, that's the free T3. And think of the 98 in the purse, that's the total, or I should say, and the total represents all of it. Now, in general, T3 is more active, right? It's about 300 to 400% more active. So it's important that we are able to look at this malconversion. A lot of people don't have this adequate conversion. And then some people even have an increase in reverse T3, which is this kind of sidestepping metabolic pathway that will increase as a way of slowing down the body. And then the next step after that is the antibodies, because the antibodies are very important, because if there's autoimmune attack going on here, that's going to exacerbate the autoimmunity, or that's going to exacerbate the thyroid inflammation, and it's going to decrease the gland's ability to functionally make thyroid hormone. So we got to look at TSH, T4 free, T3 free, T4 total, T3 total, reverse T3, and then primarily the thyroid antibodies, TPO, and thyroglobulin. So that kind of wraps it up with the thyroid testing. I can go into the functional versus optimal range in a second, but I want to give you an opportunity to ask a question there.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And I think sometimes what that takes is a certain assertiveness within the patient, quite honestly, that if they're doing it down traditional medical path, that they are advocating for the fact they want more than just the kind of surface level of tests. And I think one of the challenges that one faces certainly here in the UK is that because the way medicine is generally funded by the National Health Service, endocrinologists and GPs are quite limited in the testing that they will be able to get funding for under the NHS. And I suspect it may be a little different in the US, in as much as that people are willing to do tests because people's health insurance or people are paying for it privately. But then you've got the kind of the narrow perspective that often you've got with an endocrinologist, which is, no, this is the thing that we look at. So it takes a certain courage and a certain kind of ability to self-advocate for the patient to make sure they get that breadth of testing in the first place.
Exactly. It's really hard, because we'll go into the ranges here in a second, is there's two different philosophies at play here, right? So the allopathic mentality is health exists very in an up or down, left or right, black or white, very binary kind of model. So for instance, if you have a disease, that's like the light on. If you're healthy, the light's off. It's it. It switches either up, lights on, or down, lights off. In functional medicine, health or disease or dis-ease, dis-ease, dysfunction exists like a dimmer switch. It's on a continuum. So if, for instance, if the light on equals disease, well, what if the light's only 80% on, right? Because that dimmer switch has a continuum in which it can exist. It's not fully binary, off, on, 1, 0, right? So what if the light's 70 or 80% on, right? Well, in conventional medical world, they would say, well, if it's not all the way on, you're totally fine. But let's say you're 70% towards a disease, meaning there's a whole bunch of symptoms behind you that are accumulating and affecting the quality of your life. You're basically told, you're fine. What they're really saying is, hey, how we're looking at and internalizing your situation is, let's just say it's late, you know, it's going to take longer for you to come up on our radar, because we're not looking at you as sensitive as a way as a natural functional medicine doctor would. So we got to understand their thinking, right? It's apples to oranges. Patients say, but my endocrinologist says I'm fine, or this. It's like, yeah, because you're not, the light's not 100% on. You're 70 or 80% on. You got to know what they're looking at compared to what we're looking at, right? Health's a continuum, right? It's a spectrum. They're looking at it. It's very binary. And that's the difference kind of in that mentality perspective. Does that help?
Totally. And I think, of course, one of the challenges here is, how do you even get those averages and those reference ranges? You take a snapshot of the population and you find the averages, and then you stretch based upon that. So
yeah, you have two standard deviations to the left and to the right. That basically creates a bell curve. 95% of the population fits in that. So essentially 2.5% on the high, 2.5 on the low are considered in disease ranges. Well, number one, go to an airport. Go just sit there and just people watch for an hour. 95% of the population is not healthy. I'm sorry. It's pretty bad. Also, well, who gets more thyroid testing? People that have thyroid issues or not? People that have thyroid issues. So of course, then the range becomes even more skewed, because the more data points to make that range, you're like weighing in more patients that have thyroid issues that are getting
these tested. That's the worst 5% of the 100 people that do it, right?
Exactly. So if here's the reference range, we're looking at the 95%. We're looking at that middle third to middle 50% as kind of being the sweet spot. So versus here, we're looking at it more from here. And then, you know, our danger zones pop up when we start to get into that, you know, outer third on each side. So we're picking things up before it becomes an extreme issue.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, one puts it, say, in the context of those reference ranges in adrenal fatigue. And it's like, if you've got Addison's disease or you've got Cushing's or something, it's like, you're going to know about it, and your, you know, endocrinologist is going to pick up on it. But because you don't have one of those things, it doesn't mean that everything is functioning normally, as we're saying here with the thyroid.
So 100%. It's the dimmer switch. You're okay. Your light's 80 or 90% on. You're not all the way there. So they're going to just tell you, you know, hey, go home, get sicker until that light's all the way on, until our methods are sensitive enough to pick you up.
Yeah. And it may be that the light never goes on, that you're just going to be at a suboptimal level. And of course, these things can be a little bit out of balance and have an enormous impact in terms of someone's quality of life and how someone's actually feeling, particularly given what you were saying about the triangle earlier with the adrenals, the thyroid, and mitochondrial function, that there is a kind of an interrelationship between those pieces. So someone may be a little bit out of balance on their thyroid, a little bit on their adrenals, and a little bit on their mitochondria, but that collection together stacks up to someone hardly being able to get through the day.
Yeah. And then what happens is there's a couple of curveballs start to happen. If you're persistent enough and you're saying, hey, something's wrong, even though they tell you, you know, you're fine, what tends to happen? There's three different pathways that tend to be activated. The first one is, if you're older, hey, you're just getting older. This is just what getting older is like. And you just have to deal with it and accept it and shut up. That's number one. Number two, here's an antidepressant and a script for a psychologist. This is all in your head, you know, sorry. Or if you're a female that's cycling, hey, you know, this could be hormonal issues, here's a birth control pill. So it typically is one to three of those categories. And it could be a combination of all of them too, especially women are five times more likely. And if you're in your 30s, they may recommend a birth control pill. Here's an antidepressant and we can't help you anymore, right? It's in your head.
Yeah. And so then it kind of goes back to what we were saying a little bit earlier, that it takes that determination and that kind of that self-advocacy of the patient, and then working with a practitioner that really understands how to work from a functional point of view. And I think that's a good dovetail to track back to what you were saying about, so you have this three kind of part model you were talking about.
Yes,
kind of,
yes.
SSF. So break that down a little bit more and maybe say a bit more about some of those. So if we go upstream to the kind of the beginning of that process, what some of those stressors might be, and yeah, to break that down a bit more for you.
Yeah, so let me just draw out a simple patient. I see about 60 patients from all over the world every week. So I mean, a typical patient that may come in, we may do a really in-depth history, and we may find, like, in the stress bucket, right, we have physical, chemical, and emotional. They may be doing CrossFit, right, or doing too much exercise, right, for them. And we run their history, and they're really tired at the end of the week or after their workouts, so not able to recover. So they may be on that physical bucket, there's a lot more exercise, right? Maybe on the chemical bucket, right, the chemical stressors, they're eating gluten. Maybe there's some extra inflammatory junky omega-6 fatty acids in there. Maybe they're skipping meals, and they're trying to do this intermittent fasting thing with weak adrenals, right? So we have some blood sugar stressors, some inflammatory stressors, and then maybe they have some issues with their work. They really don't like their job, or there's some financial stress in their life. So now they're already putting these stress balls in our metaphorical stress bucket, right? And in the research world, we know that as allostatic load. So their allostatic load is being stressed. And then now symptoms are starting to show, or I should say, now our systems are being taxed. So our adrenal system, our hormonal system is being taxed. We're starting to see aberrations in the female hormones. We're starting to see inability to deal with stress. We're starting to have poor digestion. We may have infections going on. Our detoxification pathways may be a little bit taxed, and we can't quite excrete the chemicals in our environment. And then downstream, we're starting to have fatigue. We're starting to have a lot of PMS. We're starting to have a lot of depression and mood issues. And then cognitive-wise, a lot of brain fog. We can't quite function at work. So you can see in this kind of made-up patient that I've seen hundreds of times, they repeat themselves over and over again. This is a typical pattern that we see, starting from the stressors to the underlying system imbalance and how that manifests from the stressors, and then to the very end stage with the actual symptoms.
And I'm guessing what often when people come in, what their expectation is, particularly if they've come from a more allopathic medicine perspective, is you're going to fix the symptoms. It's like, what can you give me which is going to correct the symptoms of this, or to raise my kind of my thyroid levels or whatever. But what you're really saying is that if you don't deal with the stressors in the first place, that you're going to be quite limited in the impacts you can have.
Exactly. And then there's some things that we can palliative do to kind of help downstream, to allow them to feel better faster. But we just got to make sure that the root cause is not being ignored as well. So we got to do it on both ends if we're going to do it. That's number one. And there's an X factor here too. The X factor with a lot of this is conventional medicine tends to ignore autoimmune thyroid issues. And they do it for a couple of reasons, because of the immunosuppressive or corticosteroids that would typically be used to address autoimmunity. Well, those medications tend to have more side effects than the actual person that has a thyroid issue to begin with. So conventional medicine tends to not look deep enough with autoimmune thyroid issues, just because it's a risk reward kind of, you know, ratio or analysis they're making, where those medications really, they aren't necessary because they're side effects. So because of that, the underlying issue, which may be autoimmunity, tends to not even be looked at and assessed to begin with because of the treatment options for it.
That's really interesting. So what you're saying is that they're, because they don't feel they have good treatments anyway, what's the point in finding out and getting clarity? So I guess you're talking about Hashimoto's.
It doesn't change anything for them. Now, for us, it changes everything, because if we know there's autoimmunity going on, we want to provide treatment to the underlying stressors and systems, and then watch the antibodies or watch that autoimmune attack drop, which tells us that we're actually getting to the root underlying issue, which is the immune issue too.
So that's a good place to talk a bit more about Hashimoto's, because I think that that's another, as we kind of unpack this thyroid piece more, it's an area which is probably massively underdiagnosed. And, you know, it's one of those ones where one can easily get caught up in the symptoms, and again, without tracking back to what's really underlying that and what's really behind that. So if you see an autoimmune thyroid, a patient or someone that's potentially got Hashimoto's, what would you treat that differently to standard weakened thyroid, or would it be the same fundamentals you'd be starting with?
I mean, there's similar fundamentals, just because there's a great chance of, let's just say, a false negative regarding autoimmunity. So even if we test or assess someone for autoimmune thyroid, and let's say their TPO or thyroglobulin antibodies come back negative the first time, I'm still making the assumption that there's an autoimmunity going on at some level. Because number one, because the big issue is we start off with an autoimmune template, not autoimmune diet, because there's certain foods that, number one, can drive that autoimmunity and drive that gut permeability that we tend to need for that autoimmune reaction to begin with. So with gut permeability, we have like our tight junctions in our gut. And when we have inflammation and we have certain foods, especially gluten, maybe even casein and dairy and other foods, our tight junctions start to open up. And then undigested foods can get into our bloodstream and rev up our immune system. So we're already cutting out a lot of the food stuff that could be unzipping that gut lining. All right. Number one, the foods are already healthy to begin with that we're adding in, and the foods that we're pulling out aren't uniquely nutritionally dense or providing some sort of value that we couldn't get in other foods that are more anti-inflammatory. So the diet and lifestyle changes are already going to be knocked in to begin with, but also kind of creating expectations on how this person can heal. Some people may need thyroid hormone for life, depending on how long there's been an autoimmune attack in the background, because that's going to attack and beat up that thyroid tissue, and those thyroid follicles may no longer be functional and may not be able to make enough thyroid hormone to begin with. So because of that, it helps us to kind of draw up expectations, and it gives us some good markers of to say, hey, how are we doing as treatment progresses? Can we watch these antibodies drop? And that's really encouraging too.
It's interesting that you're saying that what I'm really hearing you say is that even with autoimmune thyroid issues, that often, even though you're saying that, and I appreciate that you may still need to supplement with hormones, the a key piece of the jigsaw is still what's happening in terms of gut function. So yes. Maybe to say a bit more, and you've already touched on it a bit, but say a bit more about why gut function is so crucial to a healthy thyroid.
It's a great question, because 80% of your immune system is in your gut, right? We have it in our galt and our malt, right? Galt is our gastric associated lymphoid tissue, right? Lymph being our lymphocytes, which are neutrophils, lymphocytes, monocytes, eosinophils, basophils. These are our immune cells. Okay. And then we have our malt, which is our mucosa associated lymphoid tissue in the small intestine. So 80% live in that type of area. So if we're chronically stressing out our gut, we have poor digestion, food's not digesting, we have putrefaction, rancidification, fermentation of our foods, and we have inflammation, and we have inflammatory foods coming in, and then we have our gut lining opening up, and we have all these undigested proteins and lipopolysaccharides getting into our bloodstream, our immune system is chronically firing. our immune system sucks up lots of energy as well. So not only could we be exacerbating and intensifying the attack on our thyroid through this gut inflammatory leaky gut mechanism, the immune system will also suck up a lot of metabolic resources to deal with that attack. That's part of the reason why if we get sick, we get really tired when our immune system is fighting these things, because it's a lot of energy intensiveness to go and activate your immune system to attack things in the body. So most people are firing their immune system through stupid things like food. No, let's not make our immune system attack food. Let's let it relax so that when we have foreign invaders, we can use it for those reasons.
I mean, as you're talking, what strikes me is it's sometimes fascinating how someone can have, let's say, thyroid issues, and it may be for whatever reason, but maybe it's a budget issue, maybe it's a body can't handle too much, that practitioner starts off working with, let's say, digestive function. Works on digestive function, funnily enough, mitochondria start to work better, which then means it reduces the load, that suddenly the body starts to self-correct and self-balance what's happening with thyroid. So it's almost like you can come at things in different ways, but ultimately any way you can take a load away and allow the body to use more of its resources for other things, that you can almost, you're almost finding ways to unlock the body's own healing capacity.
Correct. There are what I call the low hanging fruit. You know, working on the diet is really important. Also making sure we can digest the foods that we're eating is really important, right? Not skipping meals, especially when we have blood sugar issues and thyroid issues, is really important. Having healthy proteins and fats at every meal, you know, no longer than 5 hours is really important. Making sure you're sleeping adequately at night is really important. And again, there's a lot of like intermittent fasting stuff out there, which can be great when your hormones are good. But a lot of times some of these modalities can stress people out. So I see a lot of people that are like, oh, I'm doing intermittent fasting, which is great. If your hormones are in good shape, that may be okay, right? Not saying it's not. It's just, is it good for you? And that's where a good functional medicine docs will look at everything and help you create that plan, what's good for you.
That's a really great point. I'd like to break that down a bit more. So this is something that we see quite a bit, that either people will come in saying, I've gone vegan because I've read all this great stuff about being a vegan. They're not getting enough protein. They're just killing their adrenals in the process, the fact that they're compensating. Or as you say, someone comes in saying, I've been reading or been listening to podcasts all about the benefits of intermittent fasting, of which there are an enormous amount. But actually, it's making their symptoms significantly worse. So maybe just explain a little bit about the mechanism of why when someone fasts, why that then causes stress and activates the both the adrenals and the thyroid.
Yeah. So in general, when we're fasting and we're not eating as much, we are going to be spitting out ketones, which are great, right? These things also have really good appetite satiating effects. So it's easy to go a long time without food, right? Number one. Number two, we'll also be going into a little bit of gluconeogenesis, which is we're utilizing cortisol to shred up some amino acids in your body and convert it into glucose. The problem is if you already have lower cortisol levels, that's where it becomes a little bit stressful, right? People that have healthier adrenals, the gluconeogenesis that may happen in the background to kind of get a little glucose going may be a little bit too stressful on the body. So number one is we can still get a lot of those benefits by just keeping carbohydrates under control, but getting more extra proteins and fats in through the diet. And that way we're not going into, well, let's just say a starvation-like effect. We're in more of a nutritional ketosis where we have adequate nutrition and calories, but we're still spitting out a whole bunch of these ketones. And the blood sugar is important. I mean, I'm macronutrient agnostic. I find most people do better lower carb initially, and then we adjust the macros. And it depends on what your body type already is. Are you kind of ectomorph and already lean, but you have thyroid issues? Or do you have a weight issue? Do you have insulin resistance? Because insulin resistance is so prevalent, we tend to start more on the lower carb, moderate, higher fat, moderate protein, and then we adjust from there. But I don't have a dog in the fight when it comes to macronutrients, but I tend to favor on the lower side just because of the amount of extra sugar and carbs that are people's diets.
And from what you're saying as well, making sure that if people have got issues with their adrenals and thyroid, that they're getting a regular top up of energy from food, so their body's not having to compensate for that deficiency.
Yeah. So here's your blood sugar, right? You wake up, your blood sugar is kind of here. You eat, you know, good proteins and fats are like logs in the metabolic fire, right? You go throw protein and fat, that's a log, maybe a little bit of kindling, which maybe is your carbohydrate. and that log burns for 4 or 5 hours. If you're number one, if it's a really cold morning and you don't start a fire and you don't have good healthy metabolism, that's a problem, right? And then number two, if you're putting carbohydrates, which are the kindling to twigs and paper on the fire, you're constantly having to light that fire all day long to keep it going, right? Because it's up, down, up, down. So the more we can prevent our blood sugar from having to go up and down, if we can kind of keep it somewhere in the middle, then we can avoid the high blood sugar spikes, which then are cause a whole bunch of insulin to bring it down, and then a cortisol, adrenaline to bring it back up. So we have this insulin, cortisol, adrenaline, and if we can be somewhere in the middle, we can buffer the high and low of the insulin and the cortisol, adrenaline. And that takes a lot of stress off our pancreas and our adrenals.
Yes, because it can get to the point when there's real adrenal fatigue, for example, the body just can't do that process. So
yes.
It's like you don't eat and you just crash.
There are exceptions to every rule. A lot of people, they listen to this stuff. If you're not a clinician, if you haven't seen thousands of patients and all you have is your experience, you're like, intermittent fasting is awesome. I love it. Or I do. It's like they're so emotional because they're connected to this issue helping them, and then they extrapolate that everyone is like them, and that's can't be further from the truth. Don't get me wrong, there are common themes that are going to be good for everyone. Like everyone should be eating some protein, everyone should be eating organic, everyone should be drinking good clean water, right? So there's certain things that I think are, let's say, absolutes, but then there are things you have to customize, and you only can see this if you've worked with lots of different people, because then you can see some of the nuances that may come into place.
It's so funny you say that. We had all of our practitioners together this morning, had a practitioner training session. We were like, one of the comments was that as soon as someone starts making absolutes about non-absolutist issues, you know they haven't got much clinical experience.
Yeah, you know that. You know that for sure. I mean, the only exceptions I would say is, okay, organic food, or okay, good clean water, right? You know, but then from there we can adjust things, right?
Yeah. A couple of specifics that I'd be curious to dip into a bit more. Do you have a position around or how do you choose where to use things like glandulars versus hormone replacement? Like in terms of when beyond the kind of dealing with the stressors and dealing with the kind of functional kind of stuff, if you need to put actual support in terms of thyroid function or adrenal function, what are some of your preferences and some of the ways you would decide the path of how to do that?
That's a great question. So I've manufactured my own glandular that has full spectrum support in there. So I love glandulars because you're not just getting T4, T3, you're getting other types of proteomorphogenic compounds, T2, which has in fact increasing metabolism, T1, calcitonin, T0. So I do always try for glandulars first. There are some people that may need tyrosine, which is a cleaner version of T4. There's some people that may need Cytomel or just bioidentical, just T3. I find most can get away with a really good glandular as long as the foundations are dialed in, as long as the diet's dialed in, as long as the nutrients are dialed in, blood sugar's dialed in, the gut is looked at. And then I like to dose mine at least 2 times during the day. I find when you're getting a little bit of T3 out of some of these things, it can kind of go up and down usually in a 4 to 6 hour period, and people may crash, you know, around 12 to 5 o'clock. So taking it twice a day, I do feel tends to help and improves that. And then I'll typically test their levels 2 to 3 hours after taking their support in the morning, just so I can see where they're at their optimum during the day.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Because if there are points in the day where it's crashing again, it's still, you can put a ton more in at the start of the day, I guess, but you need to have that kind of steady support that's there.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, they kind of use like thyroid, like a conventional medical doctor would. And it makes sense because the conventional medical doctor is typically just prescribing Synthroid or Levoxil or Levothroid, which is a synthetic T4. It's tetraiodothyronine with a sodium molecule attached to it so it can be patented. Now, why does that matter? Well, it's got a 4 to 5 day half-life. So when you take it, it's just like, it's a really slow burn. When we deal with T3, that could be anywhere between 4 hours to 8, sometimes a day, but it tends to be, let's say, a lot faster. So we got to look at it from both sides. Now, I did a summit just a couple of weeks ago called the Thyroid Reset Summit. So if anyone's listening and they want to get more information, we dove in. I talked to lots of medical doctors about some of these topics as well, but I tend to go more with the glandulars. I mean, on the prescription side, you have WP, which is really clean, three ingredients, MCT, inulin, and glandular. Then you have NP, which is good. It's got a little lactose in it, though, so that's one of the things why I'll go with WP. Then you have NP and Armour. They have a little bit of maltodextrin in there. And then you're going to have your Cytomel or your liothyronine, which is your T3. Then you have your medication, Synthroid, Levoxyl, Levothroid for your synthetic T4s. And then you have your cleaner version of Synthroid, which is Tyrosint, which is a, let's say, a liquid capsule without the extra gluten corn filler in there.
That was a lot of information. That was great.
Yeah, that was kind of a crash course. Sorry.
In terms of just a couple of questions, I'm mindful of time, but
sure.
In terms of people which are super sensitive, so there are some patients that you'll give a pretty small amount of a glandular to and they'll just go off like a rocket ship and then crash, or they'll just kind of get a load of anxiety. How do you tend to introduce doses, or how do you tend to work with those kind of sensitive patients?
Great. So number one, I find patients that are like that also have lower cortisol too. So one of the things is we'll work on the adrenals. We'll kind of give the adrenals a few weeks to a month head start, because thyroid hormone can lower cortisol, right? If you go look at contraindications for Synthroid, for instance, one of them is, or if you look at contraindications for Addison's disease, it's actually taking thyroid hormone. So that can actually lower cortisol more because you're increasing the metabolic rate, thus increasing the metabolism of breaking down cortisol, thus lowering it, right? So in my opinion, you got to clinically, you know, seeing thousands of patients, you got to look at and address the adrenals first. And then, of course, we're making changes with the diet, right? We're making changes with digestion. We're getting all the nutrients on board to make thyroid hormone too, especially selenium, especially zinc, especially magnesium, especially CoQ10. Vitamin A. So we're getting all those nutrients on board there. So when we give that thyroid as well, we have that adrenal support in the background. We have those nutrients as well. And we start off very low. And we may even do some of it sublingually just to maximize the absorption. Because a lot of people, if they've got gut issues, they may not get good absorption.
This has been fascinating. I'm mindful of time. There's a lot more that we said, but of course, there's a lot more that's out there that you've put together. So maybe say a bit more, Justin. You mentioned the Thyroid Reset Summit, but a bit more about how people could find it, about more about you and your work.
Great. So if you head over to justinhealth.com, I'm Dr. J. I have a podcast and a live YouTube channel there and blogs. And we do a lot of live videos as well, where we engage with people from all over the world. I see patients as a clinician from all over the world as well. I'll be having a thyroid, let's say, reset masterclass soon. People want to engage and learn more. And I also have a book coming out very soon called The Thyroid Reset. So kind of providing lots of good information, podcasts, blog articles, live engagement classes, and books. So that would be the best place to see me, justinhealth.com.
That's awesome. Yeah, you seem to be a bit of a machine of putting information out there, which is awesome. And very much appreciate not only your knowledge, but your passion and energy of delivery. It's been awesome. Thank you so much, Justin.
Thanks, Alex, for having me part of the summit. I appreciate it.